vote for Viktor Orban. We know Viktor Orban reached out to many far-right nationalist and populist movements and political parties across Europe. Do you think that the loss of Orban in power is significant beyond Hungary's borders?
Absolutely. I believe that this is a game changer in Europe. Orban's power and his selling point, unique selling point, was that he can repeat and repeat electoral victory on an illiberal idea and nativist narratives and conspiracy theories. No, I think it's proven now that this is not last for that doesn't last forever. On the other hand, obviously it's a problem for Russia. It's a problem for Slovakia, some of Orban's partners in Europe, and obviously less so for the Americans, the MAGA movement. But obviously that's also pretty painful. What is sure that Orban is still there. And I think one of the major issues in the next couple of years will be whether he can stay in
Susanna,
power.
Susanna, forgive me, Susanna, for talking over you, but I'm afraid we're out of time. I have to thank you very much for joining me from Budapest. That's it from me today. Producer was Lizzie Highfield, Ryan Boyd and pressing the buttons. Jane and Fia here next.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio. It starts with listening.
Thank you, Stephen, and a very good afternoon. 2 o'clock, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
And in those 2 hours, after hours of testimony from the Foreign Office boss sacked by Keir Starmer, is the PM's position weakening? We're going to talk to the Times' policy editor, Oliver Wright. Polls say Labour will come third in Wales in elections next month, a potentially seismic change. Manveen Rana will tell us what she's hearing from voters. We're also going to talk about the South Korean religious group that some call a cult, which is approaching people on the streets of London, and our big interview after 3:30. It's very appropriate today. It is with the Anatomy of a Scandal author Sarah Vaughan on her new book, which is called Based on a True Story.
Here's the news at 2 from Daisy Steele.
Good afternoon. The outgoing head of the Foreign Office has accused Number 10 of a dismissive approach to Peter Mandelson's vetting and says he was under constant pressure to approve his appointment as US ambassador. Sir Ollie Robbins told MPs Downing Street was in a rush to get the appointment approved.
If you wanted to convey to the Foreign Office, we want this done in a steady, measured, rigorous way, those are adjectives you could have used. But instead, the direct written pressure, you don't need to worry about what I thought at the time as a non-official, the direct written pressure was get this done and get it done before inauguration.
Sir Ollie, who was effectively sacked last week, says Peter Mandelson was already being given access to highly classified information before vetting checks were complete. The Prime Minister has accused him of a cover-up, but he says he didn't tell ministers about Lord Mandelson's vetting because it was a borderline case which didn't raise exceptional security concerns. Donald Trump claims Iran has violated the ceasefire with the US numerous times. He's posted on Truth Social but offered no details. The temporary ceasefire ends tomorrow, but the US vice president is due to travel to Pakistan for talks on an extension. Iran has yet to confirm whether or not it will attend. Times foreign correspondent Richard Spencer has a prediction on that.
I would put the chances about 65-35 in favour, two-thirds, one-third. I think the regime actually is quite split on this. There's more evidence that the regime is not speaking entirely with one voice. I think the voices that are prominent are more in favour of attending.
Eight more people have been arrested following a string of attacks on sites linked to the Jewish community in London. Detectives from Scotland Yard say they've detained 7 suspects in connection with an alleged conspiracy to commit arson. Separately this morning, a 39-year-old man was arrested in Ealing over the discovery of suspicious materials near the Israeli embassy on Friday. A former X Factor finalist has been remanded in custody, charged with attempting to murder a social media influencer. Gabrielle Carrington has appeared in court, accused of hitting Claudia Zagrzewska with her car in central London on Sunday, while she was nearly twice over the drink drive limit. 2 other pedestrians were also injured outside a Soho nightclub. King Charles has paid tribute to his darling mama on what would have been her 100th birthday. Queen Elizabeth died in September 2022, aged 96. He's been remembering some of her standout qualities and moments.
That marvellous twinkle of the eye when sharing a marmalade sandwich with Paddington Bear in the final months of her life.
Baroness Karen Brady has stepped down as vice chair of West Ham United after 16 years. The businesswoman and apprentice star led negotiations for the club to move to the 2012 Olympic Stadium in 2016. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, to vet or not to vet is still the vexing question, and one that we will talk about in the second hour of this programme. It's definitely been Sir Ollie Day, though, hasn't it? And many of you still have thoughts. Shall we do Glynn's? Because it is quite funny.
And he's go on then,
not the only person to have noticed this. My in-depth analysis of the Ollie Robbins gig. Who was the bloke sitting behind him? And what in the name of sweet baby Jesus was he wearing round his neck? Well, I'm going to pass that over to my colleague to describe.
Well, it was a kind of kerchief, neckerchief, but appeared to be very slim and was around his neck as though you might be wearing it as a scarf. I should say, of course, the man might be, I don't know, maybe he's covering a scar or something. So you've got to be a bit respectful, haven't you, just in case?
Very
we don't
much
know.
So. And it seemed to be a paisley cravat.
It was paisley, yeah.
And it was being worn with a striped shirt, yeah, and a little red handkerchief poking out of a blazer. Yeah. So, Glynn, what we will definitely say is it was busy.
There's a lot going on.
And the second question that Glynn would like to posit, well, in fact, it's not a question. It's a very thoughtful observation. Emily Thornberry is clearly living her best life. To borrow a line from one of Annie Proulx's novels, she looked like a cat who's learned how to fry mice in butter. Well, she's very good at her job, Emily Thornberry.
She is the chair of the Foreign Affairs
Committee. She is, and she was doing her questions very well, Jane.
Yes, and of course, the Prime Minister passed over the opportunity to give her a job in the Cabinet when Labour won the election. But she seems to be making the best of it, doesn't she?
I wonder whether that rankled at all.
Well, I don't know.
Who will win in Wales? That's where we're going to start our journey around the politics of the nations today. We'll do that in the company of Manveen Rana in just a couple of moments' time. Then it's straight on to Park Run. Do you pop your trainers on for a quick heave-ho around your local park at the weekends? And would you mind that Nike seems to be slightly taking the mick out of you if you do? The Docklands Light Railway doesn't seem like a very obvious place to be recruited for what could be a cult, but this could have happened to our guest who will join us to talk about that just after 2:30. The religious group to watch out for is the Sin Chi Onji, which is a secret religious group hailing from South Korea. After 3:00, we're going to look back at that morning of exposure for the process of the civil service. We will do that with the Times' Ollie Wright. And a big question for you, and I bet that you've got thoughts about this one. Were you slightly scarred by your PE classes at school? It's one of Vassos Alexander's stories today. Karen Brady leaving West Ham is the other. She has been a remarkable lone female figure in the world of Premiership football for quite some time, only 23 years old when she joined the executive board of Birmingham City. I'm not sure I can imagine that happening to a 23-year-old now, Jane.
It would be very unusual.
Well, it would, and I think just because the scrutiny would be so absurd, actually. So her path through the world of top-level football is definitely one worth talking about. And after 3:30, who's our big guest?
Well, it's a great writer, Sarah Vaughan. She's had a lot of success with books like Little Disasters and Anatomy of a Scandal. You might well recall that drama, which was a Netflix show a couple of years ago. Her new one is another cracker. It's called Based on a True Story. And let me just set the scene for you. A much-loved national treasure, a children's writer beloved by everybody, she's called Dame Eleanor Kingman, is celebrating her 70th birthday in her Cornish mansion. She's got her family, she's got friends from the literary world. What could possibly go wrong? Mercifully, loads of stuff. And that's why this is another gripping read by Sarah Vaughan, who was a journalist, by the way, at The Guardian. So she knows quite a thing or two about, well, the murky, murky world of politics.
Now, this is interesting because many people have now texted in to say that the guy that we're talking about with the cravat, come neckerchief, come whatever it is actually quite a familiar sight at various hearings. So let us dig a little deeper and we'll try and find out exactly who he is.
Well, one man is claiming to be him.
What?
Yes, he's just WhatsApped.
Do you want to read that out or no, do you want to digest it
we'll
first?
We'll get Felix Forbes on the case. Okay. So apparently Tara says, I want to know who that guy is as well. He's been there at other hearings and I first saw him years ago in the audience of the Matthew Wright show on Channel 5. Well, he gets about, doesn't he? Any more intel? 0333 003 2353. Now to the most read stories on the Times website as we speak. At number three, Shabana Mahmood tells heckler to F right off over Reform UK comments. Now, this is about the Home Secretary, who is accused of out-reforming Reform during a podcast recording. She said the man who heckled her was delegitimising concerns over high immigration. The second most read story, Ollie Robbins, number 10, dismissive towards Peter Mandelson vetting. This is the Times live page. It's got all the reaction after the former Foreign Office boss talked to MPs about the appointment of Mandelson as ambassador to the US. And the most read piece on the Times website, same story, sacking Ollie Robbins over Mandelson vetting has exploded in Starmer's face. That's Stephen Swinford and Ollie Wright, who say the row goes back to what's called Starmer's original sin. And as Fee has already mentioned, Oliver Wright will be our guest at the beginning of the second hour of the programme, so after the news bulletin at 3 o'clock. Because I think it's fair to say that many of us started to listen, didn't we, to Ollie Robbins. I certainly was full of good intentions at 9 o'clock this morning on my journey into work. And I'd fallen away a little bit by sort of a quarter past ten. So we need Ollie Wright to tell us exactly what was said and quite what it all means, because there's a lot of the weeds of Whitehall here.
Well, hugely so. And like you, I stuck with it for as long as was humanly possible, given my journey into work. But I did think, is this an advertisement for joining the civil service, or is it exactly the opposite? The level of procedure that seemed to have been involved was just bewildering and almost, yes, minister at times. And yeah. I understand that some form of procedure is essential to be there. But when it's relayed to you and you still can't understand it, you do think, what is this all about? Yeah. If the man who we were talking about turns out to be the bloke who has dialed into our programme...
Dialed in?
..who we then get onto the programme, then I say prepare this edition for an award, Jane, or at least a mention in Potbitch. It's 11 minutes past two, more as we get it on Andrew, who claims to have been the bloke in the cravat. But we're going to turn our attention to something very serious, the local and regional elections, which are expected to spell the end of Labour's control of Wales. That would be a seismic upheaval and break more than 100 years of political tradition. But how did Labour get here and what might happen next? Presenter of The Story, Manveen Rana, is looking into this and she joins us now from Swansea. A very good afternoon from us in London, Manveen. Set the scene for us. Just how bad is it looking for Labour?
Oh, I think it would be fair to say catastrophic. You know, this is absolutely the Labour heartland. This is where a lot of the Labour movement began 100 years ago. They voted Labour solidly for over 100 years now. You know, we went to Swansea University to speak to a sophologist yesterday, and we met him in the James Callaghan building, who, apart from being a Labour Prime Minister, was also an MP for Cardiff. Ramsay MacDonald, the very first Labour Prime Minister, was an MP down the road in Aberavon. There was Keir Hardie, who also has a building named after him here, who, you know, was a founder of the Labour movement and represented Merthyr Tydfil. So, you know, it is a place that is completely embedded in Labour. You speak to people here and they say for generations, almost like a religion, people have voted Labour and yet they won't now. You know, in 2 days of speaking to a lot of people around Swansea and the Mumbles, I only met one woman who said she would vote Labour, and that was because her dad was a miner and she said he'd be looking down on me now and I don't think he'd approve if I voted for anyone else. It's that sort of history that is actually making the only person we spoke to who's going to vote Labour, but everybody else is having a real moment of disillusionment. many of them for sort of similar reasons to the ones you hear across the country, you know, the cost of living crisis, people with small businesses really feeling the pinch because of business rates going up. But there's sort of like a double whammy of disillusionment here, not only because they've always been very loyal Labour voters, but Welsh Labour has run the Senedd ever since devolution. So for the last 27 years, they've had Welsh Labour in charge here. And for about a decade and a half, they were able to say the only reason we can't do more, you know, the NHS isn't exactly as we'd want it, the roads need fixing, but we're not getting enough money out of the Conservative government in Westminster. They now have the problem of, you know, it should have been an advantage. It's actually turned out to be a huge problem of having Labour, as they put it here, on both ends of the M4. So there's nobody left to blame. So if the only thing people are seeing coming out of the Senedd that they see and recognise as a policy is a 20 miles per hour speed limit, there are real questions about why they're not able to do more and why the government in Westminster, given that it is now a Labour government, one that many people here voted for, doesn't seem to have remembered them when it comes to services, when it comes to sort of spending more on education or the NHS in Wales. I actually went and spoke to some locals in a pub in the Mumbles, the Victoria Inn, lovely place, very warm. And this is just a little taste of what we were hearing.
I've changed my mind, and I think Wales has not had a great service under Labour for the past 20-odd years. I think dissatisfaction with the mainstream Labour Party has meant that Plaid is now in its ascendancy. And it might be a good thing for Wales. We can only try it. We've tried everything else. I mean, but Keir Hardie, you know, the big Labour, big hitters, wonderful. And Nyrond Bevan. These people are pygmies compared to those.
I think Wales has probably traditionally been very Labour supported, and I think there was a lot of hope that they would do well, and they do well for small businesses, and we own this pub, we own another publishing business as well, and I can honestly say it's been one of the worst governments for business. You know, everything, they just don't seem to understand that if you haven't got business, you haven't got jobs, and if you haven't got jobs, you know, people are going to go on welfare. And I think a lot of people feel let down.
That's just a taste of what we've been hearing. I've spoken to a lot of people who say that not only have they always voted Labour, but for generations their families have, but they won't now.
So who falls into that vacuum of disappointment and in some cases despair? And what's their promise?
Well, that's a really good question. To be honest, the majority of people I've spoken to here identify as being left of centre. So they don't want to vote Labour. They feel disillusioned with them. They're looking for an alternative on the left. Many of them are going to Plaid Cymru. Some are going to the Greens. Others are just still uncertain about which way they'll vote, but it'll be one of those options. There's a big determination to try and keep reform out from a lot of the people who are on the left. There are some people now, and this is very new for this part of Wales, but there are some people who are turning to reform, partly because they're not the Tories, you know, because of the history of the mines. There's been a sense that you could never vote Tory here. A lot of people have said that, whereas reform aren't sort of tarred by that history of what happened during the 80s and the closure of mines. So there's sort of, they see them as just sort of a protest vote, really. There's a lot of anger and frustration at all incumbents. And I think, you know, even people I've spoken to who are thinking of voting reform, mostly it is quite obviously a protest vote where it's not necessarily they hold a great deal of hope for what might come next. It's much more that they feel things can't really get worse. And that was sort of summed up by a man called Philip Matthews, who I spoke to yesterday, and his little taste of what he said.
I haven't voted. I'm 55. And last year I voted for the first time. Basically, Labour, Conservative, got no competence at all, any of them. And I think probably Nigel Farage. I'm not sure about him, but I feel like all politicians lie. And I think they lie to get in, and then when they get in, they get in their seat. That's when they start changing, they're moving the goalposts. And I think that Nigel Farage is the best of a bunch.
D- Do you get any sense, Manveen, that there might be quite a large, shy reform vote out there? Because, as you said, to put all of this into context, anybody who is moving in a political circle in Wales at the moment is doing so against a background of solid Labour. And you can completely understand why some people might not want to be very open about a different direction of voting that they would be taking.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And, you know, it is the norm to be left of centre here. So it is probably harder to talk about being reform if that is the way you're thinking of voting. You know, having said that, there is a big chance that this seat will actually go reform because the vote on the left will be split between Plaid, some people still voting Labour, some voting Green. And just to make things even more complicated, which is exactly what you wanted, I'm sure, there is a new PR voting system in Wales for these elections, the Dahont system, which is almost impossible to explain cogently, so I'm not even going to try. But it basically means there will be sort of six seats per constituency. So you might end up with two of the seats here going reform, two of them going Plaid, and then, you know, the others being divvied up between some of the other parties, because it's you end up sort of having to divide the biggest party by two. And so it goes, honestly, look it up. It's an awful system to try and explain in a radio interview.
Well, if it's okay with you, I won't.
don't go there. Thank God. But it does mean it's even harder to predict, actually, which way a lot of these seats will go. And it's also made it much harder for people who are, you know, I was talking about some of those people on the left who are trying to work out tactically how they should vote. Some of them say they want to keep reform out. They don't want to vote Labour. They're trying to work out where their vote will matter. And it's much harder for them to know because there have been boundary changes. There are more seats than ever. And there's this new PR system just to confuse things.
Manveen, thank you for explaining that to us. That's Manveen Rana. You can hear her on the Story podcast. 20 minutes past two.
There is an emergency debate in the House of Commons right now. Kemi Badenoch on her feet, leader of the Conservative Party. They are talking about Peter Mandelson, and we'll bring you a flavour of that. Let's go there now, in fact.
I beg to move that this House has considered the matter of the government's accountability to the House in connection to the appointment of Peter Mandelson. And can I thank you, Mr. Speaker, for granting this important debate. Yeah. The Prime Minister personally decided to appoint a serious known national security risk to our most sensitive diplomatic post. Peter Mandelson was not just a man who had already been sacked twice from government for lying, not just a man who had a public relationship with a convicted paedophile, but a man with links to the Kremlin and China. Links so close that they were raised as red flags with the Prime Minister before his appointment. Yesterday, the Prime Minister did not deny that he knew about these links before he appointed Mandelson. He could not deny this because, by his own admission, he had seen the documents that proved the links. I cannot overstate how serious a matter this is. The Prime Minister sent a known security risk to Washington to a position where he would see our most important allies' top secret intelligence. What if he had seen something and leaked it to one of our enemies? How much would that have damaged our security partnership? We cannot even be sure that didn't happen. What is most extraordinary is the Prime Minister appointed Peter Mandelson before vetting was complete. He did this despite a letter from the then Cabinet Secretary, Lord Case, clearly expressing to the Prime Minister that the process required security vetting to be done before the appointment. So how can he then have claimed on the floor of this House that the process was followed when he knew that it had not been? He mentioned the word process, Mr. Speaker, more than 100 times in Parliament yesterday. But he was the one who didn't follow that process.
Yes.
This morning, we have heard the bombshell testimony of the former Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins. Sir Ollie Robbins had a long and distinguished career serving ministers. He is not the sort of person to give us a frank personal account of how things played out last January. So when he told us today that Downing Street put the Foreign Office under constant pressure to clear Peter Mandelson, that Number 10 showed a dismissive approach to Mandelson's vetting process, when he told us that it would have been very difficult indeed to deny clearance and that doing so would have damaged US-UK relationships, we know he is giving us the slightest indication of how bad things were. That there was actually an overwhelming drive from the Prime Minister's office to ensure Peter Mandelson was installed as ambassador. He has told us that Number 10 showed no interest in the vetting, no desire to wait and ensure due process was followed. In fact, the Cabinet Office even questioned the need for Peter Mandelson to be vetted at all. The same Cabinet Office that had discovered Mandelson's links to Epstein, China and Russia in its due diligence. The Cabinet Office, which the Minister is in charge of right now. Instead, Mr. Speaker, according to Robbins, the focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly. And before the vetting even started, Peter Mandelson had already been granted access to, and I quote, highly classified briefing on a case-by-case basis. This is what the Prime Minister calls full due process. Now, yes, I will give way.
Also in the testimony today, did she not find it astonishing that that the ex-leader of the Foreign Office said that he was made to understand that before they had completed their clearances, that Mandelson already had strap clearance, which gives him access to the most secure and most dangerous information held by government?
Can I thank my right honourable friend for that intervention? He is absolutely right. It is extraordinary. It is shocking. Now, the Prime Minister might have refused to answer my question around his knowledge of Mandelson's links to the Russian defence company Sistema yesterday, but that is only because he knows we know the answer. It was there in the due diligence. Yep. His choice of ambassador, retaining an interest in a Russian company linked to Vladimir Putin after the invasion of Crimea. And the Prime Minister's response to seeing that information? According to Robbins, constant pressure on the Foreign Office to get the appointment done. The Prime Minister, as my right honourable friend has just mentioned, placed top secret intelligence in the hands of a man he knew to be a national security risk. He did so before the official security vetting, not just knowingly, but deliberately, and to an extent that left a senior civil servant with a distinguished career under the clear and obvious impression that the vetting must return only one possible outcome, that Peter Mandelson was appointed. None of this was following full due process, by the letter or the spirit of that phrase. This is no longer just about what the Prime Minister was or wasn't told. This is about what he did before the vetting process had even started.
Yes.
And we now know that Mandelson wasn't a one-off. According to Sir Ollie Robbins, Number 10 also asked for the disgraced Matthew Doyle, the Prime Minister's then Director of Communications, to be made an ambassador. Astonishingly, the Prime Minister's office even told Robbins to keep this request a secret from the Foreign Secretary. The idea that it is Number 10 who are the victims of others not following due process is quite frankly laughable. The Prime Minister told Parliament yesterday that it was staggering that Ollie Robbins had not shared the recommendations of the UK security vetting with the then Cabinet Secretary, Chris Warmold. But today, we learned from Robbins that he had never seen the original vetting file. So if the Prime Minister is furious that Sir Ollie Robbins did not share the vetting details with him or the former Cabinet Secretary, why is he not furious with the Cabinet Office for not sharing it? Put simply, why exactly did he sack Ollie Robbins? It is no surprise the Prime Minister is not here today. These are difficult questions. He cannot claim not to have known about the risk Mandelson posed because he saw the due diligence that disclosed it, as he said yesterday. I still find it inconceivable that despite that failure of vetting being a front-page news story, no one in Number 10 was aware of it. He cannot deny that his decision put Britain at risk. And the British public deserve to know how this failure happened. and they deserve to hear it from the Prime Minister himself. Yesterday, he had the chance to set the record straight, but members on all sides, and no doubt the public, were left wholly unsatisfied with the answers he gave. I am sure they will share my deep disappointment that the Prime Minister has chosen not to be here today. There remain serious questions about the decisions he took over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, but the Prime Minister does not want to answer any more questions today, and so in typical fashion, he has thrown someone else under the bus. So I feel for the Minister sent out as a human shield for the Prime Minister. It's not this Minister who made the Mandelson appointment. That was above his pay grade. He cannot tell us what the Prime Minister was thinking when he made those decisions, and he will not be able to provide this House with the answers it deserves to hear. But this is simply what the Prime Minister does. Sue Gray, Matthew Doyle, Morgan McSweeney, Chris Warmold, Ollie Robbins, Peter Mandelson. These appointments were the Prime Minister's decision, people the Prime Minister chose to appoint, and all people he then chose to sack. Are we meant to believe that all these people are the problem rather than the Prime Minister's judgment? As usual, his explanations yesterday left us with even more questions than answers. He says that he was justified in appointing Mandelson before vetting because of advice he received from the then Cabinet Secretary, Chris Warmold. But how can this make sense when that advice only came after the scandal had erupted? Post hoc advice is pointless. Soon after this, he then sacked Chris Warmold. So why is the Prime Minister now relying on the evidence of the very man he told us was doing so badly in the job that he sacked him? But let's move on to the Prime Minister's claim that no one in Number 10 was aware that Mandelson had failed his vetting. Because enough people in Whitehall knew, enough people knew for journalists from The Independent, The Mail and Sky News to find out. Journalists have released texts with the Prime Minister's Director of Communications where they made Number 10 aware of this fact. He did not deny this story was true. Why not? Something simply doesn't add up. Despite this, the Prime Minister went on to assure this House, to assure the public, that Mandelson's appointment was down to a failure of vetting. I cannot fathom how the Prime Minister can still claim not to have misled the House on this point. It is telling that when given the opportunity to apologise for misleading the House, even inadvertently, by my honourable friend for Berwickshire, Roxburgh and Selkirk yesterday, he chose not to. I suspect that he chose not to because he knows that if he did, he would be bound by his own words, bound by the standards to which he held previous Prime Ministers from this very dispatch box. In 2022, he said that if the Prime Minister misleads the House, he must resign. Either he is a man of his word, or he thinks there is one rule for him and another for everyone else. Mr. Speaker, unbelievably, half of the permanent secretaries who were in post when Labour took office less than 2 years ago have gone. The sacking of senior civil servants to carry the can for the Prime Minister's failures has already cost taxpayers more than £1.5 million in payouts. This is before Sir Ollie Robbins. It is quite something for the former Cabinet Secretary, Lord O'Donnell, to warn that the Prime Minister has created one of the worst crises in relations between ministers and mandarins of modern times. He said that the sacking of Sir Ollie Robbins risks having a serious and sustained chilling effect on serving and prospective civil servants. Another former Cabinet Secretary, Lord Butler, has said the Prime Minister put Sir Ollie in an impossible position.
Yeah, he did.
These are serious people who are calling out the Prime Minister's behaviour. The former head of propriety and ethics and deputy to the Cabinet Secretary, Helen McNamara, has called the decision to sack Robbins unacceptable. She said that if they had published the papers that Parliament demanded back in February, that's the government, if they'd published that, this argument would be so much easier for everyone because we would all be operating on the same basis, the same facts. She's right. The delay in publishing the information required by the humble address is shocking. Where are the key annotations? Where are the decisions and meeting records? The box returns, as they are called, in Downing Street. Why are crucial forms left blank? These missing documents add to the mystery. Why is the government still trying to cover this up? Yes, I will give way.
I thank my right honourable friend for giving way. She will remember I asked the Prime Minister yesterday in the box note of the 11th of November, where Simon Case recommended that vetting went through before the appointment was made. The Prime Minister's decision note did not include the Prime Minister's decision, and it's been redacted from the conditions of the humble address. Does she think that the answer that has been redacted would show what the Prime Minister was trying to achieve by appointing Peter Mandelson without the appropriate vetting?
Can I thank my honourable friend for that intervention? He is absolutely right. Why were the Prime Minister's words redacted? These are key pieces of information that will help solve this mystery. Much easier for us to see and understand than the words which he was giving at the dispatch box. I note that no Labour MPs have intervened on me. This is very unusual. Normally, when I'm standing here in a debate, they're all bobbing left, right and centre. Mr. Speaker, I'm raising these concerns because of the seriousness of the situation the country is now in. With war in Europe, war in the Middle East, a cost of living crisis and a global energy shock, we need a Prime Minister who has a grip on national security. Yet last week, the former Labour Defence Secretary and former NATO Secretary General, Lord Robertson, warned that the Prime Minister had a corrosive complacency when it comes to defence. This is the same man who wrote the Prime Minister's Strategic Defence Review. He is ringing the alarm bell, warning us of the grave consequences of the government refusing to take the tough choices needed to increase defence spending. This matters. Because if we cannot trust our Prime Minister to tell the truth about this ambassadorial appointment, the whole full truth, a key appointment in Britain's national security architecture, it calls into question the assurances he gives us on everything else. His promises to control taxes, which he has broken. His promises not to raise borrowing, which he has broken. Promises to back business, protect our veterans, defend our farmers, and prioritise growth. All of which he has broken. And he has broken them because at his core he is a man with no idea what he believes. Worse still, he appears to have no interest in doing the job of Prime Minister, just in being the Prime Minister. Curiosity is what drives serious leadership. Without curiosity, problems are neither fully understood nor solved. And this whole affair just goes to show why this country is heading in such a woeful direction under the Prime Minister's incurious regime. His defence yesterday summed it up. He says that no one told him and that he never thought to ask. This is, in his own words, incredible. But even if we take the Prime Minister at his word, even if we believe the unbelievable, it is no better. He appointed Mandelson despite knowing that he was a threat to our national security. He said due process was followed, having failed to follow that process himself, and he pressured the Foreign Office into signing off on this appointment. In 2022, the Prime Minister said, "I believe that if you're the leader, the buck stops with you." He said, "I will always stand up for my team, but I will also take responsibility for everything they do." That is what leadership is. How has he taken responsibility? It is clear that the Prime Minister has no intention of facing up to his mistakes. It's clear now that he is not a leader and he has no intention of doing the honourable thing.
On that point,
yes, I will give way.
I congratulate her on securing this debate and indeed on eviscerating the Prime Minister in her speech. Does she not believe, however, that the sorry souls opposite us should have to put their money where their mouth is and that there should be a vote of no confidence in this Prime Minister in due course?
The Right Honourable Gentleman makes a very good point. I think he is right, because I don't believe the Prime Minister has the intention of doing the honourable thing himself, even though that's the standard to which he held everyone else. The decision, as I said, about whether he will ultimately take responsibility for his actions is now up to Labour MPs. We heard many powerful statements from that side of the House yesterday. Labour MPs know that the Prime Minister has let the country down, he's let Parliament down, and he's also let the Labour Party down. It is clear to everyone, except the Prime Minister himself, that he has failed on his own terms. It is clear to the public that he is failing at the job. It is clear to civil servants that he is throwing them under the bus. And it is clear to members across this House that he is not fit to lead. Yeah. This cannot go on. This House deserves better. The country deserves better. The Prime Minister is not fit for office. Yeah. The first duty, Mr. Speaker, of any Prime Minister is to keep this country safe. This Prime Minister has put the country's national security at risk. Yeah. Yeah. He must take responsibility. It is time for him to go. Yeah. Yeah.
The question is, as on the order paper, John Trickett.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Speaker. And there are many ways of developing a culture how to run the government in Number 10. I was a witness in the years from the financial crash through to the defeat of the Labour government between 2008 and 2010. And I saw a Prime Minister who would never have come to Parliament or said privately that there were some facts of which he was unaware, because he was a man of detail. He was a man of a large vision, and he's a man who drove the state forward. Now, we may disagree, and I do personally, with some of the decisions he took, but that is a different culture than the one which the two previous Prime Ministers, Truss and our friend who, with his blonde hair, used to offer a culture in Number 10 of the exotic. And we went from the exotic to the toxic. And the fact of the matter is, I did not hear members on the opposite side asking questions about the culture of those two Prime Ministers, though they're here today in great numbers. They contributed to the mess which this country...
Mr. Turner, the man who speaks, you just walked right in front. Sorry, John Trickett.
Mr. Speaker, so those two Prime Ministers in particular, the chaotic and the exotic, left this country in a disastrous situation. But I do think that a Prime Minister comes to the House and relies, or implies that he relies on a culture of simply a process, is mistaken. I think the Gordon Brown model, flawed as it was, will be far better than the one which we've heard of from the Prime Minister. I'm sorry to say that, because I want to support a Labour government that's effective. But that is the case. I saw it with my own eyes. I saw the vetting, I saw the decisions, I saw the pressure, I saw the tumult, and I saw Prime Ministers struggling with their party to deliver a different kind of society and a different kind of economy. Now, let me just turn to the present events. What did we learn from Sir Olly today? I think there are four things which matter. First, that the Security Department had tended to be wanting to refuse the vetting of Mandelson when Sir Olly first arrived, although others had said we don't need a vetting of any kind. And then, whilst the vetting process was going on, the government proceeded with the, or appeared to proceed with the appointment of Mandelson. And even the King and the United States administration were told that he would be the ambassador. The British state then conspired to deliver a positive vetting, because that is what they believed the government wanted. And that was expressed in repeated phone calls from the private office in Number 10, which I was very familiar with in those years, to Sir Olly's private office. The pressure, according to the witness we saw this morning, who looked credible, made a very serious case that he was under pressure to proceed. And no, I'm going to make progress. There are many people standing on all sides, and they may well be pleased with some of the things I'm going to say, because I'm going to develop an argument and I want to proceed with it. The question which I haven't heard answered is, why was it that a group of people in Number 10, and possibly the Prime Minister as well, felt that that level of pressure should be placed on the Foreign Office in favour of appointing Mandelson? And I think there are two possible answers, but let me focus on one. I think that the political unit in Number 10, and possibly the Prime Minister too, wanted Mandelson because he was their close political ally and because he was plugged into a vast international network of what we like to call the billionaire class. The truth is that much of the nexus of wealth which Mandelson was plugging into was, and so was the president, by the way, was centred around Epstein. And let me just pause in my narrative for a second. None of this debate, none of these facts would emerge were it not for the courage and bravery and resistance of the women who had been treated so appallingly on Epstein Island. But getting Mandelson into Washington as part of that network was the highest priority. A political network of highly reimbursed billionaires.
Well, that is senior Labour MP John Trickett on his feet in the House of Commons in that emergency debate on the appointment and the vetting of Lord Mandelson. Some interesting moments there. Kemi Badenoch, I mean, she's pretty fiery these days, isn't she? She doesn't take many prisoners. She was good again then, said it's time for the Prime Minister to go, and she was congratulated by an unusual admirer, it has to be said, the leader of the SNP, Stephen Flynn, who praised her for eviscerating the Prime Minister, he said yesterday. So that is all still happening in the Commons. We'll have more on the big story of the day a little bit later. Certainly after 3 o'clock, we'll check in with Ollie Wright, the Times policy editor, who will take us through everything that Ollie Robbins said in front of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee this morning. That's next here on Times Radio. It is, about 3:15 now.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages, every night from 10 o'clock on Times Radio.
When life gives you that hump day feeling, Deliveroo gives you the fuel to power through with a top-up shop delivered in as little as 20 minutes. Keep the fridge full with your favourite essentials from Co-op, Morrisons and Sainsbury's. And even better, our freshness promise means your fresh and chilled groceries arrive fresh or you get your money back. Deliveroo. Now, just got even better. Geographical restrictions, T's and C's and fees apply. Delivery times vary. See app or web for info.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
McDonald's cards are here. 24 cards to find and free food in every pack. Enter cards in the McDonald's app and complete sets with over £4 million in cash prizes to be won. McDonald's cards. 18 plus UK only with selected meals subject to availability. Ends 27th of April. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
There is a land steeped in ancient history, myth and legend, where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. This spring, start your own story in Scotland. From wild mountain ranges to bustling cities, witness Scotland bloom into life this spring. Explore its dramatic landscapes and uncover our ancient Celtic roots. Experience vast lochs, majestic glens and lofty mountains. All easily accessible from our many vibrant cities and towns. Scotland is the perfect place to find yourself. Whether you're looking for scenic hikes or a stay in a cosy cottage, there's something for every type of traveller in Scotland. And with an exciting range of festivals and sporting and cultural events to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
I'm going to read these messages in the order in which they came in. Simon says, why is so much time being given to Badenoch right now? She's repeating herself ad nauseam. I've turned off. Nauseating drone. In above is RHW Garden Services. A lovely free advertisement for you there. This is just a witch hunt now. Big Kev says, surely the question Labour MPs will be asking themselves now is that anyway Labour can win the next general election with Keir Starmer as leader. And Gary says, oh dear, Times Radio comes away from the House of Commons because Fionn Jane's beloved Sir Keir is under the cosh.
Yes, that's right. Gary has, he's found out what we're up to, hasn't he? Gary, I thought we'd getting away with it.
Jane was very complimentary about Kemi Badenoch's performance.
I think Gary heard that bit.
And her, in particular, her scrutiny. And she has also tried to hone in on what everything that has happened might have meant for our security if things hadn't been unearthed. Mm. And actually, that's a slightly different tack from the procedure.
Well, it makes it much more
been adhered to, and
relevant.
It makes it relevant to us.
Exactly. Yeah. Because to be honest, well, you know, the goings on behind the scenes, what form was filled in, who saw what and when, most of us do lose interest.
It can leave us a little bit cold.
It can.
But a threat to national security that may or may not have been posed by someone who'd failed special vetting procedures is very much relevant to all of us. Glyn is very much the third wheel in this programme, isn't he? And we'd like to thank him for drawing our attention to something that many people who were watching the Select Committee this morning might also have noticed, which was a gentleman sitting behind Sir Ollie who was wearing some very stylish neck attire. And Glyn wanted to know a little bit more about this. And, I mean, holy oboes. Only a couple of moments later, we were contacted by Andrew Edwards, who said, I'm the man who was sitting behind Sir Ollie. So we've got in touch with Andrew. He joins us now. Very good afternoon.
Hey, what an absolute honour and pleasure just to be talking with you two.
Yes. Oh, what a lovely guest you are.
I tell you what, you've won. Thank you very much, Andrew. Look, they love what you're wearing. They really like the look of you. How do you get into these things? What's your modus operandi?
Well, my modus operandi is just as your guy said right at the beginning, he said I was on the Matthew Wright show years ago. I've been doing the circuit of sitting in audiences for the last 20 or so years. Matthew Wright, great guy. Jeremy Vine, great guy. Question Time, bad people. So I just go and listen and just hear what they've got to say for themselves, just so that I've got a flavour of how government and how people's thinking works.
How do you get into a Select Committee? I can understand the other programmes, actually, but a Select Committee I would have thought was slightly harder for people to have access to.
Oh, no, I've been to them all, my friend. I go to the Ayrton Committee to watch Keir Starmer in action. When the government got in, I've been to see lots of first-time ministers appear before a Select Committee. The great thing about Parliament is that because it's open, and I also am one of those sad people who hang around the courts, I go to the Court of Appeal quite regularly as well to listen to what our top judges are doing, because you can just sit in the public gallery and listen.
Andrew, do you have another job apart from this?
I do. I teach advanced public speaking skills. So I teach people to sit up straight, answer the question, focus on the person who's speaking. That's why I'm focusing on you two, and I'm hooked on every single word that you say.
Ouch. Oh, dear. Don't look too closely, please. How did you think Sir Ollie did today?
Oh, I don't think he was as good as the media is making out. His first job was to sat up straight. Lots of people slouch these days, but if they sit up straight and then give a direct answer, it conveys so much more authority than slouching and not finishing your words promptly.
We're both trying to do that.
Yeah, we are. We're so focused on that, neither of us could move our mouths at all. I don't know if you were listening earlier, or perhaps you were actually, when Manveen Rana was reporting from South Wales on the upcoming elections there. And she talked to a man who was 55 and had never voted, but was thinking this time of perhaps going towards reform. I guess he's almost your polar opposite, isn't he? Because you sound hyper-engaged in every aspect of British public life.
I'm only hyper-engaged because we did it at school. Right? When I was at St. Anthem's School in St. Helens on Merseyside, we learned civics, so we were taken to the local council to watch. I've got to say, though, my father was a miner, my grandfather was a miner, so they were involved in miner strikes and digging for coal from the 1950s onwards. So we've been a very industrialised family for quite some time. But lots of people don't vote, and it's their right not to vote. And as your commentator actually said, that political parties have not done very well with Wales in the mines, and Reform haven't quite got that tag.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Before we let you go, Andrew, talk us through how you dress in the morning. And that question has come out saucier than it was meant to. I'm mainly talking about your cravat. You've got a striped shirt. You've got a little handkerchief as well. Do you dress like this every day?
I don't dress like it absolutely every day. Even I do have my off days. But I thought as I was going to lie with be at a major committee, the least thing I could do for Parliament, of course, was to dress up smartly for Parliament. And you're quite right about the cravat, because I did get the idea that sometimes, especially in this weather, your shirt might sweat, and the last thing people want to see is some elements of sweat around an untidy shirt. And then you can't go wrong in black when you wear a black jacket, my friend.
Well, you do look very dapper, and it got you noticed. Mm. And thank you for calling in. This has been.
Can I just say, you two are the sweetest women I have ever talked with. So it's really, really great.
Yeah, you don't know us, Andrew, but we're extraordinarily grateful for the compliment. Ask our colleagues what we're really like. Thank you, Andrew. Honestly, he looks great. And I love his enthusiasm for all these things.
Yeah.
And he is, of course, right. You can just go to the courts. I know not everybody wants to knock around the Court of Appeal or any court, but they are public places and Parliament's there for you. You can check in and watch stuff. I think it's great.
I admire him too.
Yeah. Let's go to the doctors and bring in Dr. Rachel Ward, who is our resident GP. Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm really well, thank you.
Good. Now, we're going to talk first about a potentially really terrible story. This, the rise of illegal steroids in gyms could be fueling a surge in liver cancer in some young men. Now, Stephen Wigmore, who is the Regius Professor of Clinical Surgery at the University of Edinburgh, blames the manosphere for creating what he calls a silent killer. Now, we don't want to over-egg this. Mostly the numbers involved here are not high. But what is going on, Rachel, and what should people be wary of?
Yeah, so Steve Wigmore has made a really good point here. So I think there is a large number of people who are using anabolic steroids illegally, obtaining them illegally, and they're using them for, you know, bodybuilding, increasing their muscle bulk. And of course, that is linked in with the whole vibe of the manosphere. We know that that is something that is promoted. Now, what Professor Wigmore is saying is that what he has seen, he's certainly seeing cases of young men who have been using steroids in this way, and they are then presenting with tumours in their liver, some of which are untreatable. So this will lead to death, unfortunately. And this is a complication which very few people are aware of. Now, I can completely concur with this. I do see people who are using anabolic steroids, and I'd say it's fairly common for them to be aware of things like change in anger. You know, we talk about roid rage, and that's fairly commonly known. Some people know that it can reduce your fertility, but I think very few people are aware of this severe impact it can have on your liver, and also severe impact it can have on your heart. It can cause cardiomyopathy, it can cause blood clots, and it can cause different types of heart disease. So this is really serious. As you say, thankfully, we are not talking about huge numbers. As his words, this is not an epidemic, but we are seeing these cases that are very, very serious and potentially, you know, life limiting, which, you know, just shouldn't be the case with drugs that are being sold illegally.
No, okay. I mean, there's no way a GP would prescribe anything like this, is there?
No, absolutely not. So, of course, we use certain sorts of steroids, different forms of steroids for specific conditions. This is steroids which are being different forms of steroids being used illegally purely for increasing muscle bulk.
Right. OK, so people be wary. Now to the gut, which could be the key to identifying somebody at risk of Parkinson's disease many years hence. Now, what's this all about, and how can a neurological condition be linked to the gut?
Yeah, fascinating study that's come out of UCL. Basically, where they have identified, they've looked at people with Parkinson's, healthy volunteers and also a group of people who carry a gene which increases your risk of developing Parkinson's disease. And what they have noticed is that there are specific differences in the gut microbiome. So the makeup of those billions of bacteria that sit in our gut, you know, healthy bacteria, and there seems to be a pattern, a difference between people who have Parkinson's and also those that are at risk of developing it. And we think that there is, you know, a correlation between, you know, people who are going to develop Parkinson's in the future. Now, we're not saying that this is a cause-consequence situation, but there certainly seems to be some link. So could this be used in future to identify people who are, you know, potentially going to form Parkinson's much before they get symptoms? Could it lead to a kind of early intervention possibility? Or in fact, is there a specific cause between the gut that we don't yet understand or don't yet know? But it's a fascinating discovery and, you know, just comes back to this same old messaging of the importance of our diet and our gut and looking after what we eat.
Right. So just in order to get a good gut, what do you need to eat? Yeah. It's all the good stuff, isn't it?
It is. So looking after your gut microbiome, you need a lot of fruit and veg, you need fibre, that key word that we keep hearing about. You know, you having some fermented food in your diet, very good, legumes in your diet. So lots of those kind of good plant-based things and some fermented things. But yeah, variation also incredibly important.
Do you enjoy the fermented products that I know everybody's in love with at the moment?
I don't have huge amounts. I'll be honest. I can have a bit of kefir. I'm not a massive kimchi eater, but I do recognise that it's good. So a little bit is good. You know, try and get a bit in.
Yeah, we do have sauerkraut in our fridge, and the younger generation seem particularly fond of it. I've never understood it myself. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Rachel Ward. Dr. Rachel helps us out with health matters every week at around this time.
Get your kombucha on, Jane.
I tried to get down with the kids.
It could put some whiz into your Wednesday.
No.
Try some tonight. Holy oboes is one of those phrases from the early Batman and Robin series.
Is it?
Yes. Hayley made an inquiry about that. There are loads and loads of holies. And if you ever have a moment to spare, have a look through them, because they'll just make you chortle a tiny bit.
You're being modest, because you got up to grade 8, didn't you?
You did.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio. It starts with listening.
Pick it up more. I didn't get any grades. Fantastic.
Yeah, but welcome to Double Read, half hour. It's 3 o'clock. It's not. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come before 4 o'clock, football has lost its most high-profile female executive. We'll discuss Baroness Brady's departure with Vassos Alexander. And our big guest after 3.30 is writer and journalist Sarah Vaughan, discussing her latest book, which is called Based on a True Story. All of that will happen after the very latest news. Here's Daisy Steele.
Good afternoon. An emergency debate is underway in the House of Commons over Lord Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador. Former Foreign Office Chief Sir Ollie Robbins told MPs this morning Number 10 took a dismissive approach to the vetting process and applied pressure to push his appointment through. He maintains the Foreign Office acted correctly, despite being sacked, for not informing the Prime Minister that Mandelson had failed checks. Downing Street rejects that account, insisting Robbins made an error of judgment. Speaking in the Commons a short time ago, Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch was highly critical of Keir Starmer.
Peter Mandelson was not just a man who had already been sacked twice from government for lying, not just a man who had a public relationship with a convicted paedophile, but a man with links to the Kremlin and China. Links so close that they were raised as red flags with the Prime Minister before his appointment. I cannot overstate how serious a matter this is.
Donald Trump claims Iran has violated the ceasefire with the US numerous times. He's posted on Truth Social but offered no details. The temporary ceasefire ends tomorrow, but the US vice president is due to travel to Pakistan for talks on an extension. Iran has yet to confirm whether or not it will attend. The Times World Affairs editor Catherine Philp thinks that's a power play.
I think the Iranians are trying to get themselves back to a position of strength. So they're playing awkward and suggesting they're not going to show up. I think in the end, they will have to show up.
Eight more people have been arrested following a string of attacks on sites linked to the Jewish community in London. Detectives from Scotland Yard say they've detained seven suspects in connection with an alleged conspiracy to commit arson. Separately this morning, a 39-year-old man was arrested in Ealing over the discovery of suspicious materials near the Israeli embassy on Friday. A former X Factor finalist has been remanded in custody, charged with attempting to murder a social media influencer. Gabrielle Carrington has appeared in court, accused of hitting Claudia Zakshrevska with her car in central London on Sunday, while she was nearly twice over the drink drive limit. Two other pedestrians were also injured outside a Soho nightclub. Baroness Karen Brady has stepped down as vice chair of West Ham United after 16 years. The businesswoman and apprentice star led negotiations for the club to move to the 2012 Olympic Stadium in 2016. There's been a surprise drop in the unemployment rate. It's dipped from 5.2% just before January to 4.9% for the quarter ending in February. And King Charles has paid tribute to his late mother on what would have been her 100th birthday. He suggested she may have been deeply troubled by current events. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. The number, if you want to get in touch, 0333 003 2353. Earlier on today, we heard from the very man other listeners had talked about who was sitting behind Ollie Robbins at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee this morning, wearing, what was it again, a paisley
cravat, a striped and a shirt, yes, and a little red handkerchief.
Yes, so I got that wrong. So it's a paisley cravat, the red handkerchief and the striped shirt.
Yes, this is like Jim's game now. Yeah. Is it Kim's game? I never remember.
It is Kim's game. So that was him. And I've got visions. I can see him again now on the monitors in the studio here. Anyway, he only contacted us himself and came on the programme. Just think of that. What are the chances? Anyway, we were grateful to Andrew, his name was, wasn't it, for coming on. Jan just says, I wonder what time Andrew had to get there to get that prime seat. Jan, I wish we'd asked him. He's a man who does lurk around the Palace of Westminster, as he freely admitted. He also goes to courts as well and goes into the public gallery, as any of us can. There's nothing to stop any of us doing it. Anyway, it was lovely to talk to him, and it's always good to get intel from listeners about what's going on out there, so we're very grateful to you. The number is 0333 003 2353.
And just a couple of points of order, because we did take Kemi Badenoch's statement in the House of Commons. It does mean that we've pushed a couple of things back. We're not going to do Park Run today, and we're not going to talk about joining a cult until possibly later in the week. But thank you very much indeed. I think it was Kate. Who had sent a first-person experience of a near miss with a cult. We will hang on to that, Kate, and bring it into our discussion when we get to that, hopefully tomorrow or the day after.
Should be tomorrow, but a bit of a busy old afternoon. We are going to talk between now and 4 o'clock to Vassos Alexander about the sports news of the day. Karen Brady leaving West Ham, which is actually quite an important event in British football, and we're also talking about school sport as well, or Vassos will be, and whether your experiences of not being picked at school for games, for teams and things, has stayed with you and put you off exercise right through the rest of your adult life. So we'll talk to Vassos about that. And the big guest after 3:30, the very successful novelist Sarah Vaughan, who has another cracker out. It's called Based on a True Story. It's about a much-loved children's author celebrating her 70th birthday in some style,
but it all goes horribly, horribly wrong. Right, let's go back to politics. Downing Street exerted constant pressure on the Foreign Office to clear Peter Mandelson for his job as ambassador to the US. This, according to the former head of the department, yes, it's Ollie Robbins, who told MPs this morning that Number 10 was dismissive of the idea that Lord Mandelson required vetting before he was appointed as US ambassador.
I think throughout January, honestly, my office, the Foreign Secretary's office, were under constant pressure. There was an atmosphere of constant chasing. When will this
daily phone calls?
I couldn't say for certain daily, but I mean certainly very frequent, from private office to private office. Has this been delivered yet? Never any interest, as far as I recall, in whether, but only an interest in when.
So when you say private office to private office, you're saying private office of Number 10?
Yes, I am.
Right, that gives you a flavour of what was discussed this morning. Well, Ollie Robbins was sacked by Sir Keir Starmer last week, with the PM saying the Foreign Office deliberately didn't tell him that Mandelson had failed security vetting. MPs, as you know if you were listening in the last hour, are now debating the appointment of Mandelson in the Commons, with parties including the Tories and the Lib Dems calling for the Prime Minister to go, and I think Stephen Flynn of the SNP and Kemi Badenoch of the Tories agreed that perhaps a vote of confidence or no confidence in the Prime Minister might not be a bad thing. Let's talk to Oliver Wright, who's the Times policy editor. So I think if we can just make this super, super simple, Oliver, for people who are interested but not obsessive about the way Whitehall works. They wanted Mandelson, they, Number 10, wanted Mandelson in that role, and they didn't really care how it was achieved. He just had to get the job. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is, you're so right. This gets very knotty very quickly, and it's hard to sort of cut all the chaff away from it. But yeah, that was the impression that Robbins gave, that you know, Downing Street had announced in public that Mandelson would be the next ambassador, and basically saw everything else as a formality. And Robbins' argument is actually developed vetting wasn't a formality.
Right. Well, this point about Downing Street being dismissive about vetting was made pretty forcefully by Ollie Robbins. Here he is.
The handover briefing I was getting as I arrived at post was what I felt was a generally dismissive attitude to his vetting clearance. The focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly. Despite this atmosphere, an atmosphere of pressure, the department completed developed vetting to the normal high standard. Because the vetting process is not there to determine fitness for office or reputational risk, it's there to protect national security.
National security is a point that has been really taken up by Kemi Badenoch in the Commons in that emergency debate this afternoon. Do you think that perhaps that's the point that many ordinary voters will be really interested in?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so far as sort of ordinary voters are paying attention to this, the big question is, you know, surely you must have known that Mandelson was a risk. He wasn't, you know, he'd been in public life for decades. You know, people remember that he had to resign twice. And there's a sort of, you know, Starmer claiming ignorance over this. I just don't think washes. And I think this is where Kemi Badenoch is making some points that may resonate, that, you know, it didn't actually even need developed security vetting to know that Mandelson was potentially a liability. And it comes down to this question of Starmer's judgment. Should he have not have thought this all through to begin with?
Well, the expression "the dogs on the street" always comes into the mind of those of us who've knocked around news for some decades. People did know that Lord Mandelson, Peter Mandelson, had a story. There was quite a lot of stuff allegedly in his locker or in his locker that everybody who took an interest in current affairs knew about. And isn't that really at the heart of this, that in spite of all that, as Diane Abbott was saying yesterday, in spite of everything that everybody knew, he was still wanted for this position? So what are we to make of it?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, strangely, that was the point that Ollie Robbins was trying to get across. He was basically saying, look, you know, Starmer should have known that there are reputational risks in doing develop vetting while an important part of the process. And he was at pains to, you know, make clear that, you know, the Foreign Office had gone through that process in the proper way. I think there was a sort of strong undercurrent of, you know, Starmer took the wrong decision originally to decide to appoint Mandelson, and certainly took the wrong decision to decide to announce Mandelson's appointment before he had been vetted and before the various checks could have been done.
Right. So who at number 10 was the keenest on Mandelson getting that position? Do we now know who that person was as a result of what Ollie Robbins said this morning?
We do know, not specifically as a result of what Ollie Robbins said this morning. I mean, he talked very much in terms of the private office to private office. But he did. He was asked at one stage about comments made by Sir Keir Starmer's then chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, who had supposedly told his predecessor, Ollie Robbins' predecessor, that is, Sir Philip Barton, that he just wanted Barton to get it done. He used an expletive in that, which I won't repeat. Yeah. And that was the view that, you know, the Foreign Office was seen as an impediment to doing what Number 10, and particularly the political side of Number 10. Morgan McSweeney, as everyone knows, is a political appointment. They just wanted it done, and they felt that the Foreign Office was being obstructive in getting it done.
I don't know if you've been able to watch the debate in the Commons. Keir Starmer isn't there. He wouldn't be expected to be there, would he? What would you say about that?
No. I mean, he obviously made that statement to MPs yesterday, a form of preemptive attack against what Robbins had to say to the Foreign Affairs Committee today. So he sent out Darren Jones, who's got this title of the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, to represent the government. But I do think, you know, Downing Street now have questions to answer, not least this fresh revelation that Number 10 also sought a position for Matthew Doyle, yeah, who was Starmer's Director of Communications. Again, another political appointment. And, you know, Robbins made clear that he and the Foreign Office thought that this was completely inappropriate. It was basically trying to find a job for Doyle because Starmer no longer wanted him as Director of Communications. So he was looking for a sort of foreign sinecure for him. And that was batted away. But I think the very fact that Downing Street sort of went to the Foreign Office and said, you know, what plum postings have you got, is not a good
thing. Well, and it gets worse because this man, Doyle, was later sacked for his links to a convicted paedophile. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of, you couldn't make it up territory.
Right. So what happens next?
That's the really big question. So the Foreign Affairs Select Committee has not finished its inquiry into this. So this is only one element of that inquiry. So they will be looking to call further witnesses. I think you can be pretty sure that they will call Sir Philip Barton, Sir Ollie Robbins' predecessor, as head of the Foreign Office. Now, he was in post at the time when Downing Street decided to nominate Mandelson and basically pushed it through. So what he has to say on this will be fascinating. I think they will probably also try and call Morgan McSweeney, Starmer's former chief of staff now, to ask what role he had. But, you know, they can go anywhere that the evidence takes them. They may want to call other officials who were involved in this process. So, yeah, I think this has some way to run. And, you know, it is difficult for Starmer because obviously you've got local elections next month. You've got more documents on Mandelson that are likely to come out after that as part of this big disclosure process. So this is a sort of slow burning scandal that distracts Downing Street at a time when it really wants to be thinking about other things. And I think we've got some way to let it run.
Right. So I didn't realise the next batch of Mandelson files won't be released until after the elections. So no one's going to want to be Labour leader on May the 8th, are they? With the possible exception of Keir Starmer.
No, and I think that is the thing that is possibly underpriced in all of this. That while, you know, yeah, a very large number of Labour MPs are not impressed by Starmer as Prime Minister, would ultimately like to see the back of him before the next election, there is no real appetite to get rid of him now. I think there is a sort of feeling that they don't really know who they want to replace him. There is quite a bit of time before the next election. So in a way, Starmer stays wounded by default in Downing Street, but sort of there, but not fully in charge.
Yes, I mean, I wonder how many people think along the same lines as our listener, Mike, who says the last thing this country needs is another period of political instability and the inevitable rise in UK bond interest rates. So that's something on Mike's mind. A lot of other people will just think, oh, you know what, I'm really worried about what my heating bill is going to be like next winter. I'm sick to death of all this gobbledygook and infighting and politicians, frankly, thoroughly enjoying themselves hurling abuse at each other. This has got nothing to do with me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think calmer heads among Labour MPs would share that sentiment. They would say, look, voters are not following the twists and turns of the Mandelson scandal. They're not even following, you know, some of the big stories about, you know, Labour MPs plotting to get rid of Starmer. But the one thing that will register with everyone is if there is a leadership challenge. And then it won't be, oh, well, it's good to get rid of Starmer, let's get someone fresh in. It will be, oh, no, they're just like the Tories. We're going back to where we were, yet another divisive leadership, when actually we want politicians to be focusing on things that really matter to voters.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you. That's Oliver Wright, The Times policy editor.
You can email us with Jane and Fee at times.radio. Our WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. We are going to talk about whether or not your gym classes, as they used to be called, your PE classes at school, scarred you for life. Tracy from Cambridgeshire says, during my first hockey lesson at middle school, we were handed heavy wooden hockey sticks. Not knowing how to use mine safely, I swung it back fast and high, like a golf club, ready to hit the ball. Unfortunately, a friend was standing behind me and my stick knocked her unconscious. After the ambulance took her away, I was given a place on the school hockey team for having gusto. We were both scarred, but in different ways. She was all right in the end, Tracy. But yes, that puts into context my next question to all of you. Have you held on to any emotional scars from school sports lessons? It's 18 minutes past three.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
We'll bring you full reaction as Ollie Robbins is questioned by the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Alex Thomas, former Principal Private Secretary to Sir Jeremy Hayward, Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service, joins us alongside the big political brain of Times Radio's Adam Bolton. And with peace talks in the balance in Pakistan, we'll look at Iran's appetite for a deal with Jeremy Scahill, whose reporting during this war is always notably close to the regime. We'll see what he thinks.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7. On Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Subscribe to Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So we'd love all of your stories about whether or not your gym classes, your sports classes, your PE classes at school left such a lasting impression on you that you didn't fulfil your potential. We're going to talk about another big sports news story today, though, because Baroness Brady, Karen Brady, has stepped down as vice chair of West Ham after 16 years. She is football's most high-profile female executive, and it follows concerns from fans about the club's performance on the pitch, as well as their finances. All of this with Vassos Alexander. Should we just do the finances first? Because West Ham has made a loss of, I think, $42 million on the current books. But that's, in football terms, not a vast amount of money.
Yes, sort of tish-pish, $40 million.
That's fine. So this is actually very much about Karen Brady just saying, I've done my time there. There are other reasons, aren't there? She's noted her unhappiness along her journey.
If you look at the Times Online, I think it's Martin Samuel who writes, if Baroness Brady of Knightsbridge is sick of football, then that's football's problem more than it is hers. I mean, she has come in for dogs abuse from West Ham fans in recent seasons, before that from Birmingham City fans. She persuaded David Sullivan to buy Birmingham City in 1993, and then aged 23, she became manager managing director, which was unheard of for a woman in a very much a man's game at that stage. And she has stayed in football. She married Paul Pesci-Solido, who was one of the Birmingham City players. They're still together. They have two kids. In fact, as far as I understand it, she was in maybe Dubai at one of their kids' bedsides, who was about to become a mum for the second time, while she persuaded Nuno Espirito Santo to become manager of West Ham. She did all the sort of the behind-the-scenes
business.
Well,
she's a woman, she's multitasking.
Yes, she really was, yeah. So she did all the behind-the-scenes business at West. She didn't really get involved in the football side of things. Declan Rice's transfer to Arsenal aside, because of the big sums of money involved and that sort of thing. But she was, you know, she was the person, you know, she helped West Ham beat Tottenham to the now London Stadium after the Olympics, to the tenancy there, and 50,000 season tickets at the London Stadium, which I only found out when I was reading about her legacy just now, having decided to step away. This has been known. She said her goodbyes, by the way, for some time inside football. So her last day actually was the 15th of April. Nuno Espirito Santo, the manager, has known for many weeks that she's stepping aside. But those around her have just said, you know, enough is enough, and finally she's listening to them.
So she has said along the way that if she had her time again, she wouldn't have bothered entering football because, as you've alluded to, some of the abuse she's received has just been horrendous. And it's absolutely because she's a woman.
Yeah. There was some video doing the rounds on social media. Unusually for him, David Sullivan left the match early. West Ham were losing, I can't remember where, perhaps at Tottenham. And he was confronted by some West Ham fans who'd also left early. And he was being given a load of abuse. And then they started on Karen Brady. And the language that they used and the whole sort of tenet of their argument was just, it was just awful. Just really awful. There was a banner at Anfield a few seasons ago, which just made some awful claims about how much damage they'd done to East London. The West Ham fans, a lot of them, and, you know, there is an argument as to whether the London Stadium has the sort of the charm and the atmosphere of the old bowling ground Upton Park. Certainly a lot bigger. It's quite difficult to get to. So that's an argument. But just don't bring in, you know, and so they can criticise for that. But it's not, it felt personal when it was with Karen Brady. And she is, I mean, she is, like you said, she's the most high-profile woman executive in football by far. I mean, Alison Britton is chair of the Premier League. Debbie Hewitt is chair of the Football Association. But both would walk down the street and not many people would recognise them. But no. Karen Brady, because of, you know, The Apprentice and the fact that she's been at the heart of football for so long, the heart of top-level football for so long, she is just so recognisable. It's a big day today.
Yeah, it is. It's a very significant day. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think men's football has done its level best to take on racism. It's done just about nothing about sexism.
And homophobia.
It's awful, actually.
Yeah. I mean, there is now one, as of last weekend, Europe's top five leagues, male leagues, now has a female manager, Marie-Louise Etter.
She got a load of abuse as well.
Yes, she did. Yes, she's the manager until the end of the season at Union Berlin. There are still no openly gay male players in any of Europe's top five leagues. One in Australia and Jake Daniels, I think, at Blackpool. But you know, that is something that football has to really sort of get a hold of, because the, you know, the misogyny in football and the homophobia in football is a continuing problem.
Martin Samuel's piece is so well worth your time today. And he talks about this banner that it was in the away end at Anfield,
yes,
which said, "Brady, Sullivan and Gold, you've done more damage to the East End of London than Adolf Hitler." And as Martin goes on to say, to clarify, there were between 40,000 and 43,000 civilian deaths in the London Blitz and up to 139,000 wounded. Roughly 1.4 million were evacuated, meaning one quarter of the capital was displaced. He's just got a wonderful way of putting things into the right perspective.
And little wonder that she's decided to walk away. I mean, amazing that she kind of put up with that sort of stuff for so long.
What do we think she's going to do next?
I understand, mostly from reading Martin's piece, that she's the House of Lords. She wants to do that, and she wants to pursue other business interests. Plus, she's on The Apprentice, of course.
Yes, yep.
Which is very successful, one of the BBC's more successful shows.
She won't be unbusy.
No, she won't.
Let's talk about PE. A poll has found that PE and sports at school puts 3 in 10 people off sports for life. Now, I'm surprised it's only 3 in 10, Vassos, because just when we were talking about this in the production office before coming on air, most people's story was one of embarrassment, mild humiliation, and certainly not enthusiasm when asked about their early experience of PE. It's just not great in schools.
Well, here's the thing, and the trouble is that it does put people off for life. Girls especially, you know, in those teenage years. So this is 2,500 people, middle-aged adults. 3 in 10, as you say, said past sports memories from school put them off exercise for life. Half said they used to dread PE lessons. Many have never done sports since, believing exercise is, quote, something only young people do. 2 in 5, so nearly half of adults, remember being picked last in teams. What? I don't know if that still happens at school. I suspect not, but all lined up against the wall. You know, I'll take you. You just dread being last. Didn't you? It was awful. I still remember where I was when I was picked last. It only happened a couple of times, but it was awful.
Well, you see, I would have thought that you would have been brilliant at sport at school, and so this, you know, this experience wouldn't ring true with you. But you say not.
No, I can run a long way. But I picked up sports in my 30s. I remember at the 2012 Olympics, we were broadcasting on site from a big shipping container that had been turned into a studio. And Chris Evans asked Jess Ennis-Hill, who just won heptathlon gold, what's it like being so fit? I mean, arguably the fittest woman in the world. And she said, I don't really know, because I've always, you know, been really fit at school. But I do know, because I never was particularly fit until I hit my 30s and I started running. And a life with sport in it, with running in it, with some sort of fitness in it, is just immeasurably better than a life without. And I think this is what this campaign, it's called Act Now, Age Better. It's an Age UK thing, but it's been backed by over 40 sports organisations, the LTA, Sport England, British Cycling, just to get people to start moving, to sort of put aside those memories of being picked last at school and to start exercising in middle age, because it just, you know, objectively, better outcomes.
Yeah, so we can all just put our collective memory in a box with the with the terrible smelly gym mats and all of our
and being body conscious in PE, all of that stuff. If we can just like put it aside and just, you know, start, because, you know, I was terrible at sport at school, but I have absolutely, you know, in many ways doing sport defines me now. And you know, Sophie Raworth, I was just reading her book, I think it's out this week, the BBC news reader. She never knew she could run, you know, and then she suddenly found out she can run across deserts. And really well, and in an age group, and suddenly you discover that there's more inside you, and it's really invigorating, especially unlike Jess Ennis-Hill, who's always been so fit, especially if you discover it in middle age.
Well, I mean, you need to be the spokesperson for this campaign.
Well, I would love to be, yeah.
Because I'm absolutely sold. Do you know, I would say, because I know that, you know, we have lots of parents listening to this programme and quite a lot of teachers as well. I think now in schools, teachers are so aware of all the things that we've been talking about. They try incredibly hard, certainly to take away that body conscious aspect of sport. And just from my own experience as a parent and nothing else, the type of sports and activities available in schools are just mind boggling by comparison to what we had on offer. And sometimes that's the way to do it, to have movement and activity that's not always based around competitive sport. Because competitive sport tends to only have one winner, and that's just not great when you're at school.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are little things in primary schools, you know, they have the daily mile where they just get people moving, and it's not a competition. Non-races, I think there's a big future in non-races where we all, you know, like it's the London Marathon on Sunday, and everyone will start in Greenwich, and then everyone will end in the Mall, and everyone will go, well, what's your time? And yes, great, but actually, isn't it amazing that these people, 50,000 people, are going to take on 26 and a bit miles and conquer the distance? Imagine we just took the clock away and it was just about the distance. It was just a non-race. Start when you want in that sort of window and finish. Let's try and finish before 3 o'clock in the afternoon, say. And it just became a distance thing, a non-race. I think that would really help. on this sort
and
of subject.
And just about how much better you feel afterwards,
yeah,
not,
exactly.
not your placement. Mm. If you were going to take up a sport, I mean, you're only in early middle age now, Joan, what would it be?
A croquet. Well, I'd give that a whirl. That can't be difficult, can it? I mean, it doesn't.
It's very posh.
It is a sport. Well, I'm on Times Radio now.
Polo fee.
Why not?
I'm thinking maybe a little bit of real tennis.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Our listener here claims that as a young teacher teaching PE, I was shadowing a colleague of mine on how to deliver a great lesson. And then everybody realised at the end of the session he had inadvertently locked one of the girls in the PE shed as he was locking up for the evening. Thankfully, we got her out. She was rescued, hiding behind all the rugby balls, right? Matt claims that a boy in our class broke his arm playing football and another was knocked, had his front tooth knocked out on a trampoline. Matt's on the Isle of Wight. And Nick says, more seriously, actually, gay growing up in the 80s and 90s, I'm still traumatised from PE. Sometimes people were cruel. Mm. Pupils were cruel. Teachers could be pretty horrible too, couldn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's no, as you say, it's actually the most surprising thing about this survey is that it's only 3 in 10.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. Lovely. Thank you very much, Vassos. He's with us every day at around this time. If you want more on all the big sporting stories of the day, go to thetimes.com and head to the sports section. I mean, that stands to reason, really. If you want to read about sport, I think that's quite a good tip, isn't it?
But it was helpful to hear it from you, darling.
Thank you. Right, our big guest. Don't go to business. It's pointless. Our big guest is the very successful novelist Sarah Vaughan. She's joining us in a moment or two to talk about her latest tome based on a true story, which I've read, and it's great. Here are the latest news headlines. Slightly late. It's just after 3:30. Here's Daisy Steele.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Number 10's rejected a former top civil servant's claim that it had a dismissive approach to vetting Lord Mandelson for the US ambassador job. Former Foreign Office Chief Sir Ollie Robbins told MPs this morning there was an atmosphere of pressure to get the appointment through. Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch has accused the Prime Minister of sending what she described as a known security risk to Washington. Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper says ministers should have been informed of the checks.
The Prime Minister has instigated a full investigation into this entire process and into what was known and also into the whole vetting process as well.
The US president claims Iran has repeatedly violated a fragile ceasefire. He hasn't provided details of the breaches, but it's the latest in an ongoing war of words between the two sides as the deadline for the truce looms on Wednesday. 7 people have been arrested by counter-terror police over a conspiracy to commit arson at another Jewish site. Sir Keir Starmer says the government won't relent in our fight against anti-Semitism and terror. A long-serving Morrison's manager says he was sacked after 29 years for tackling an alleged shoplifter at the Aldridge store near Walsall. Sean Egan claims he acted to protect staff and customers, but was dismissed for breaching company policy during the incident. And Baroness Karen Brady has stepped down from her role as vice chair of West Ham. The Apprentice star says she's leaving the club after 16 years to focus on other business interests and her role in the House of Lords. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, we've got Simon on the line. Simon, young people, they're just all a bit lazy, aren't they?
What do you think?
McDonald's.
Can I get 6 minutes, please?
Some say young people are work shy, but at McDonald's, we hired 47,000 of them last year.
Hands in eye.
Like George here, who keeps things running during a Friday rush. Resilience. Making it happen at McDonald's.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Times Radio, it is Jane and Fee until 4 o'clock. John Pina will be here with what will no doubt be a very, very meaty edition of his programme tonight. Ollie Robbins focused, I would say, Fee. What do you think?
Well, I would imagine
so. What are you fiddling with?
Well, because the headphones...
Your socket.
My socket. The headphone jack, to use the trade term, Jane, yeah. Is a little bit intermittent. So, you know when your headphones start to break and you're going on a long train journey mm-hmm. and you find that you have to hold them, the wire, in exactly the same position...
You're doing that now.
...for maybe 3 or 4 hours. That's what I'm doing here today.
Okay. There is a budget at Times Radio, but perhaps it could be extended, more extensive than it appears to be.
Do you think they might actually get changed now I've mentioned it on air? Or I won't be here tomorrow. Yes. Let's see what happens.
Well, that's what I've longed for, darling, so that's absolutely fine with me. Elizabeth Clare says, my grandmother Dora...
That's very hurtful and very nasty.
No. My grandmother Dora took up croquet when she retired. She became captain of the Westmoreland ladies team, and she carried on playing into her 90s, at which age she was chair of the village croquet club, which at the age of 90 she memorably described as being 23-year-old creaking gates and me. Oh, 23-old creaking gates and me. So I didn't deliver that properly. Sorry, Elizabeth Clare, but thank you for the message. And your grandmother, Dora, sounds a pretty amazing woman. Quite a lot of you have had rather diabolical school PE experiences. I just didn't really. Did you?
Yes.
Oh, did you? Okay.
We had to wear very large brown pants and Airtex shirts to do any kind of indoor sport, right. Which, looking back on it, just seems humiliating and weird. Mm. And, you know, gym consisted of being expected to vault over these great big, I mean, they called them horses, didn't yeah. they? And climb up ropes, and none of us could really understand why we were doing it. We seemed to have endless country dancing as well. It was an all-girls school. So, you know, that had its merits and not. And, no, it was horrible. And it was a very, very competitive environment. And the only other available outdoor sport was lacrosse, which, if you're not very good at lacrosse, is just dangerous, actually. Yeah, very dangerous. So, yeah. No, I would definitely be in the 3 in 10. Okay. And like Vassos, it's only later in life I've discovered that I actually love sport, but I just don't want to do anything competitive.
No, OK, I have to say you won't see me in Airtex anytime soon. Right, 22 minutes to four.
I've got photographs if you want them.
Let's welcome our guest, best-selling author Sarah Vaughan. Sarah, hello, how are you?
Lovely to be here.
Now, it's really lovely to have you in. I gather I've interviewed you before, but it was on Zoom during the pandemic and we won't speak of it again. And you've got a lovely link with Fee as well. Just explain that.
This is slightly random.
Oh, so, it doesn't matter here.
So after I'd taken voluntary redundancy and was at home with two small children, Nikki Campbell was doing a Five Live phone-in about can you have it all or some sort of question like that. And I...
It's just dreadful that that was hosted by a man.
I was obviously feeling slightly incensed at this point.
Yeah.
And I can remember pulling over. I was driving, listening to it as I was driving. And I remember pulling over and ringing in. And it was obviously quite heartfelt. And I talked about how I'd worked in the lobby and, you know, David Cameron saw my mortgage details at one point. So he was that sort of contact. But right. And now I was at home with two small children. And I don't think I... divulged anymore. I signed an NDA about leaving The Guardian, but and you wrote a Waitrose column at the time, and you nosed it on this poor woman who'd rung into to a Five Live phone in and talked about the impossibility. And I'd said in it, I really hope my daughter, who's now 21 and at university and doing chemistry, and is going to fly, is going to have a, you know, it's going to find it easier. And you'd concluded by saying, I hope this woman's daughter does manage to do it. And it sounds really pathetic, but at that time I was trying to freelance and not getting much work, and I felt very validated by you nosing your column on me.
Well, so thank you. I'm absolutely delighted at that, but also just really delighted to hear that your daughter heads out into the world. I mean,
she's at university at the moment, but she's doing chemistry. And
yes,
she's, yeah.
So I hope that she will sail forth without exactly the same constraints on her. But I can't say that I'm as hopeful as I probably was all those years ago.
We're trying
ago.
To be optimistic.
Let's be, Sarah, let's, yeah.
I'm going to take over and start talking about your book. And I was going to do a link, but I can't remember what I was going to say. I think I was going to say, what we can be positive about is your amazing literary career, Sarah. I knew it was there somewhere. It's a question of grasping for it and moving along with the old voice. Right, OK. We need to say that you have written whole series of their best-selling books. They've been adapted by Netflix. There's another one in the mix now, I think. And your latest one is based on a true story. Now, we should say that you have been involved in politics. You were at The Guardian. I mean, we've already so many trigger words. The Guardian, Waitrose. I mean, I don't Five Lives.
Five Lives.
It's an absolute
the
nightmare.
The hate mail is going to shoot.
Yeah, it's not going to be great. And you were, but you were someone who always wanted to write novels and went into journalism because you thought you had better do that before you did books. What was it?
Yeah, I mean, it just never occurred to me that I could write a novel. I read English at Oxford, where you didn't have to read anything after 1832. No. And everything you wrote was by a dead white man, really. I did do Virginia Woolf, which was frightfully modern.
Extremely daring.
And so I left, and I just did not occur to me I could write a book. But I knew I'd done student journalism. I knew I wanted to write. I was actually spent 3 months at the Times. Didn't get the graduate trainee scheme, but I'm in good company with Satnam.
Klaxon's gone off about that. hope Uncle Rupert's listening.
But thanks to late managing director here, I got a job at PA.
Right.
And trained there for a couple of years and then went to The Guardian for 11 years as a political correspondent. I had this idea that I had to do news. I couldn't do features. I had to be a proper journalist and do news.
I see.
And then life in the form of two small children meant that I couldn't carry on being a political correspondent, really, with them and hours and a husband with a career as well. And so at 40, I did what I'd always wanted to do and stood up and two glasses of Prosecco fueled, announced I was going to, because nobody was... You know, nobody was publishing my freelance features. Something called the internet had come along and made it all really difficult. And so I, rather like the protagonist in this book, I wrote around my children, so to speak, when they were at preschool and started writing novels.
Okay, so you've written books based on motherhood, definitely in the past. Politics, Anatomy of a Scandal, yep. Reputation. Remind me what Reputation was
so
about.
So Reputation is the book before this. It's, again, unfortunately, it came out the week that Liz Truss mucked up the economy.
Yes.
And it's about a female MP. That's so right. Nobody really wanted to read it. but it is about, I loved writing it, and it's The Times says it's my best written book, actually, before they edit it, before they review this one. They've written a good review of this too, and it's about a female Labour MP who is it's about navigating her way in public life, and she's charged with murdering a tabloid journalist with whom she's been entangled, who's found in her home.
That's right. That is a great premise, and it's a great book. They're absolutely right.
And it's about revenge porn and it's about the online safety bill
right
at the time, so it's slightly out of date now, and he's updating.
Well, you do lots of buzzy topics in your books.
Yeah,
you do. And this is, I mean, I think you're onto something really with this new one based on a true story, because it is about a quite commonplace person in British public life, the much loved national treasure. Now, in this case, Eleanor Kingman has been made a dame for her work in children's literature. Everybody loves her, but there's always a but, and she's marking her 70th birthday. She's gathered the clans together in her Cornish, beautiful Cornish home, and of course, mercifully, it all goes totally belly up. What did you want to do with this central female character with just... We've been talking about people who've got stuff in their locker today in the light of Lord Mandelson. Dame Eleanor isn't everything she appears to be, is she?
Well, I love writing about strong women, and I hadn't really realised that this was actually something that is quite appealing to TV people as well. So in Anatomy, I've got a female barrister who's the main character. In Little Disasters, it's a paediatrician. In Reputation, it's a female MP. And I think with all good literature, I'd say, but certainly with crime literature and psychological thrillers, you're looking at the disconnect between the appearance and the reality, as we see as well in public life, you know, and that's something I've very much observed in The Lobby, and Anatomy and Reputation are very much about that as well. So Dame Eleanor Kingman is another, I wanted to write about an older woman as well. You know, so often when older women are written, they're sort of, you know, in cosy crime, or they're befuddled by technology, or, you know, there's a sort of cutoff at around 40, and my protagonists keep getting a bit older. Mm-hmm. So Emma Webster, the MP, in Reputation's 44, but I'd never written anyone older than that. So Eleanor Kingman is 70, and I think that generation of women are quite remarkable. You know, we're quite disparaging about boomers, aren't we, because we think, you know, they've gained so much financially and things, but actually they've had to break through glass ceilings, and they've had to be quite ruthless to achieve in their life.
Yes, and I'm here to say that they're not always the easiest women.
No, perhaps not.
And I don't think Dame Eleanor is all that easy and hasn't been very easy. She has got three daughters, and there are quite a few Shakespearean echoes here, aren't there?
Well, it is a feminised King Lear.
Right.
I think. Yeah. And it's partly inspired by watching Succession.
Right.
And there's also lots of little allusions to Macbeth. I did a festival at the weekend and I realised that I was finishing it as my son was doing his English literature GCSE, for which Macbeth was a set text. So it's funny how sort of you magpie. But I mean, I did, before I started writing, I had the final scene in my mind which alludes to Macbeth. But I mean, there were little sort of Easter eggs all the way through. Yeah, I've got to work those. Each of my books, I do manage to slip in a few, that English degree.
Just out of
Shakespeare
interest.
Paper.
Does your son listen to you when you want to give him tips about how to write something, how to construct a sentence?
No, both my children are STEM very much. But so GCSE was the last point at which I could snare him. And we did have a slight panic about, I don't actually know this book, Mum, so let's just have a... intense weekend, shall we say, 10 days before the GCSE.
Right, OK.
But it worked.
It did. Well, I'm very glad to hear it. Now, the contrasting characters of the daughters, the eldest is dutiful.
Yes.
And who else do we have?
And Rachel, the second one, is dutiful as well. So I wanted to flip the Goneril and Regan mm-hmm. idea. And then they're 40 and 38, and the younger sister is... There's been a bit of a gap. So when she's 8... her mother writes this huge best-selling hit. I was sort of inspired by people like Blyton and A.A. Milne, who'd kind of exploited, a bit like Instagrammers, you know, monetizing their kids now, curating their feeds, exploiting her daughter, really, and preserving her as this 8-year-old in these line drawings. So the third one, Delia, her mother has this massive hit, and so they move to this beautiful Thameside home with tennis courts and, you know, boats and, you know, orchards and things like that. And yeah. She has a very different type of childhood to her sisters, who are by this stage off at university. And so obviously she's the spoiled, subversive influencer who may have an agenda.
Well, she certainly does. I mean, she does a lot of influencing from a sort of a yoga pose position.
And the sunset. I had a lot of fun doing that. Yeah.
You may have had fun doing it, but that is real. People do get really invested in that. I'm going to say it, tosh.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that was the night, having done a lot of research for Reputation and Anatomy of a Scandal, which involved me sitting in county courts through really grim murder and rape trials, this just involved me going on Instagram looking at these terrible women. Can I say that?
Well, I mean, they're not terrible, are they? I mean, they're
terribly self-absorbed and narcissistic. Can we say that?
You just have.
Yeah.
But lots of people buy into it.
I'm very happy for you to say that. And it's quite refreshing to hear somebody say that. Because sometimes there is a notion of the sisterhood that we're all in it together. But it is a truth that at the moment, there's a certain type of woman who is absolutely encouraged to look down on other women, to bitch about other women, to undermine other women. And it's a very visual thing as well. And we respond to that, don't we? And I'm not saying that it's not the same for men, but obviously I only have the female experience. I mean, it's quite a time to be alive as a woman.
Well, I'm as guilty as anybody. I find I'm just sort of wanting to buy into this sort of snake oil about, you know, have I got cortisol face? Have I got menopause belly? And I've had to sort of catch myself and think, you're an intelligent woman. The reason you have a belly is because you're not doing enough exercise. It's not because you're not doing these special yogic poses or you're not, you know, but it's very difficult when you see these beautifully curated, even by women my own age. And I'm not interested sufficiently in Instagram to learn about filters and things. And I wouldn't do it from a feminist perspective as well. But you realise actually women your own age are applying the, because when you see them in real life, you think, oh, you don't look anything like you do on your page, you know.
I'm being chased around the internet by advertisements targeting my belly fat. Yeah. You get those?
Me too.
Belly fat
and
as
cortisol
a term.
Face. Yeah.
I find it so repulsive and insulting. And yes, I've bought several products, but it doesn't seem to have made any difference at all. But it's very odd, isn't it? We're living two parallel lives, whereas intelligent women, we know we're being targeted. But as I don't know what... we're falling for it.
Yeah. Well, it's a
constant, isn't it?
It is an absolute constant. Do you think we're all entitled to some privacy around our own backstory? I've been thinking about this in relation to your character of Eleanor Kingman, whose childhood was not what an adolescence were both deeply troubled and not what she pretended. But is it okay to not lie, but in later life be economical with the truth about who you are and where you've come from?
I think it depends a bit who you are. So if you're Eleanor Kingman,
then obviously you didn't need to say that.
Yeah. But I think if you're Eleanor Kingman, she's not harming. I mean, I've been asked, and I'm very conscious of litigious people, am I basing her on any real life person? I'm not.
No. Okay.
And clearly, bit of a spoiler, but you know, her crime hasn't involved children in any way. So, you know, obviously, if it's something like that, that's a whole different category, isn't it? I think you're allowed to be a little bit economical arguing, but not if you were in public office. So if that's what you're leading up to. I think if you write children's stories and you've had, there are mitigating circumstances, aren't there, for her, for why she does what she does.
Yeah. Well, we find out why she did.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't want to create spoilers, but I think it's all about context, isn't it? But I also think that if you're in public life, you still have higher standards than you have to uphold than if you're writing children's stories.
Now, you've done politics, you've covered politics, and we're in a situation now with Sir Keir Starmer where, I mean, he is being, the expression, hoisted by his own petard, because he really did tell us that he was going to behave in a very different way, that he was righteous and upstanding, and yet here we are. What do you think?
And I can't help, you know, I really thought he was a really decent man. I mean, that's the image, isn't he? He's the director of public prosecutions. I can't work out why they've been so, not smitten by Mandelson, but why, you know, in normal circumstances, why you would bring somebody back into government in that situation. I was in the lobby as a political correspondent when Peter Mandelson had to resign over the Hinduja brothers. Mm-hmm. And I actually looked
at... Was that the first or second?
That was the second one.
Right.
So I was just checking the date. So 1998, he had to resign over the passports, not the passports, the mortgage with Jeffrey Robertson. Because mm-hmm. I think he didn't disclose a $373,000 loan.
Yeah.
That's right. And then 2001, I think it was November 2001, he had to resign over, I think it was fast-tracking some passport for the Hinduja mm-hmm. brothers. And I can remember, because it's one of those intros that really stuck with me, and I was shocked that it actually was 2001. I looked it up just before I came in, but my colleague Patrick Winter wrote this drop intro, and he said, even Jesus Christ did not earn a second resurrection. And yet it's...
Never mind a third.
Never mind a third. It's happened, hasn't it? I was reading a biography of Ed Miliband last week, and I think he... as you do. And I think that in 2008, he recommended that Gordon Brown didn't bring him back as a business secretary, and Jonathan Powles recommended against that, and yet he was brought back. And,
well...
I just don't understand why that would happen, why you would trust someone when there were those red... When you or I would think...
Well, we've talked about this, haven't we, on the podcast? We've just, in this conversation, talked about how women are encouraged throughout our lives to judge other women. And we do it, and some of us really enjoy it. Let's just be honest about it. But why don't men judge other men in the same way?
And why do they have these blind spots? It's like, why would you... It's like Matthew Doyle. Why would he believe that the person that he was still backing and the conclusion of the sex case hadn't happened, you know, the counsellor who was then convicted for having children, why would he give him the benefit of the doubt? Why would Mandelson believe Epstein's lawyer, who after he was convicted would say, oh, well, you know, he's innocent, really? I mean, and why would the Prime Minister just have a blank spot about that? I just find it incredible because you, all of us, if somebody was involved with a paedophile in any way after a conviction, we wouldn't want them anywhere near our children, would we? And we certainly wouldn't want to employ them either.
No, so, it is. I have to say, I'm simply, I just don't understand how we've got to the situation we find ourselves in. And I know you're deeply interested in politics and the way things operate in this country. How do you think it will end for him?
Oh, well, I don't think it's looking very good today, is it? I mean, I'm slightly bemused that he wouldn't have thought that solely Robbins would come out fighting in the way that he has. I mean, it doesn't, just reading the report and listening to Kemi Badenoch going for him this afternoon, I mean, it doesn't look very good, does it? But then equally, as I think somebody was saying on your programme just before me, there's no one who's an obvious replacement.
Replacement, no, there isn't.
And there's no real appetite, is there, for...
No, I think that's probably more significant that most of us just can't face it. I mean, on days like today, do you miss the hurly-burly of news?
I do. Do you know the setting that I loved working in the most was in the lobby, because I think often lots of political correspondents are quite witty and there's quite a buzz when there's a story breaking. And I realise I'm not very good at just sitting in an office with my dog at my feet, staring at the screen, thinking, oh, this is a bit shit, isn't it? You know. So I think I do like that buzz and that movement. And, oh, it's really satisfying writing a news story really quickly compared to, you know, thinking, God, I've got to write 100,000 words.
Well, you do provide enormous entertainment. I just got to shoehorn in a very brief apology for the four-letter word.
Sorry.
Do you know, it's the second one of those we've had this week, isn't it?
Well, it is. And we've apologised for you. We didn't apologise for the other one.
We didn't. I'm very sorry. I should have apologised for the other one. And I apologise to you, Sarah, for apologising for what you said when I didn't apologise to the other person who said the same thing.
Well, I shouldn't have said it, should I?
No, you shouldn't.
No, sorry.
It's a really, really good book. I really enjoyed it. I didn't quite know how it was going to unfold.
Oh, good. That's brilliant.
So, no, you had me, absolutely, to the very, very last page. Thank you. Sarah Vaughan, based on a true story, what's really going on at the party of Dame Eleanor Kingman? Find out by reading the book. Thank you, Sarah.
You're listening to Times Radio. It is 5 minutes to four.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture. Covering all the major stories making the headlines with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elevon.co.uk.
Listen to the Times at One for an essential lunchtime roundup of all the stories making the headlines.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Nick says, wire? Well, yes, and I am still holding it in.
Yes, she's done wonders, actually. You probably get more money for that because you've held the programme together. Couldn't have done it without you holding it in. Rachel says, could you tell Vassos I've just finished reading his book, Running Up That Hill? I didn't mean to. My husband accidentally downloaded it to my Kindle. It's romantic, isn't it? I started reading it as I'm running London, my first marathon on Sunday. Oh, best of luck, Rachel. Vassos's book is about ultra running further than 26 miles. I found it really inspiring. So can you say to him, big kudos from me. I hope to channel some of his grit.
Beyond 26 wow. miles, that's a place that you and I will never go.
No, I cannot imagine. Do you know who else is doing the London Marathon? I was surprised to hear. Cynthia Erivo.
Good for
and
her.
And apparently she's done it before.
Brilliant.
So I know she's got to talk about multi-talented. Sometimes you just despair, don't you?
Is Ariana with her?
No, I think it's just Cynthia doing this.
Okay.
I'm sure her time will be wicked.
Oh, that's very good. It was quite a build-up and it was well worth it. Who is our guest tomorrow, Jane?
Who is our guest tomorrow? We're talking about the women who featured at the Nuremberg trials. There's a slight hesitancy because I was told earlier that the author, Natasha Livingston, I think it is might be unwell. But I hope she isn't because it's a really fascinating book.
OK, so we hope to be able to bring you that. And then on Thursday after 3:30, Jeremy Vine is in to talk about his latest crime thriller.
Never heard of him, sorry.
Can't place him.
No,
never mind. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Stay with Times Radio. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio. It starts with listening.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines.
Number 10 has rejected a former top civil servant's claim that it had a dismissive approach to vetting Lord Mandelson for the US ambassador's job. And Donald Trump claims that Iran has repeatedly violated a fragile ceasefire, but hasn't provided details of the breaches. And Times Radio's Ollie Cole's joining me in here in the studio with the latest on the Mandelson story at Westminster. And Sir Peter Riddell, the former Commissioner for Public Appointments, is going to be joining me too with his verdict on Ollie Robbins' big performance in front of MPs.
This is Times Radio.
Now that he's with Daisy Steele.
Good afternoon. Kemi Badenoch accused the Prime Minister of placing state secrets in the hands of a man known to be a risk to national security.
Peter Mandelson was not just a man who had already been sacked twice from government for lying, not just a man who had a public relationship with a convicted paedophile, but a man with links to the Kremlin and China.
The Conservative leader has been addressing MPs over why Peter Mandelson was given the job of ambassador to the US despite multiple concerns surrounding his vetting. Earlier, former Foreign Office boss Sir Ollie Robbins claimed Downing Street had a dismissive attitude to the need for those tests. He gave more than 2 hours of evidence to MPs this morning, defending the department's handling of the process. Sir Ollie insists the right decision was made, despite the Prime Minister taking the opposite view. Times reporter Ollie Cole has more details.
He was only 10 days in the job when this approval got over the line. He inherited a department that was under a lot of political pressure from Number 10. Constant, he said, phone calls from Number 10's private office to the Foreign Office about, rather than whether he'll get the job, when Peter Mandelson was going to get the job and trying to push this through. Similarly, there was an atmosphere that the Cabinet Office didn't even necessarily think that Peter Mandelson needed security vetting in the first place.
Downing Street rejects the criticism, saying Robbins made an error of judgment. Donald Trump claims Iran has violated the ceasefire with the US numerous times. He's posted on Truth Social but offered no details. The temporary ceasefire ends tomorrow, but the US vice president is due to travel to Pakistan for talks on an extension. Iran has yet to confirm whether or not it will attend. Times foreign correspondent Richard Spencer has this prediction.
I would put the chances about 65-435 in favour, two-thirds, one-third. I think the regime actually is quite split on this. There's more evidence that the regime is not speaking with entirely with one voice. I think the voices that are prominent are more in favour of attending.
Eight people have been arrested after a series of suspected arson attacks across London, with police warning those carrying out the attacks for money could face significant sentences. The Metropolitan Police says most arrests relate to an alleged conspiracy, with officers investigating the possible use of criminal proxies. They believe the intended target may be linked to the Jewish community. A long-serving Morrison's manager says he was sacked after 29 years for tackling an alleged shoplifter at the Aldridge store near Walsall. Sean Egan says he acted to protect staff and customers during the incident, but he was dismissed for breaching company policy. And Baroness Karen Brady has stepped down as vice chair of West Ham United after 16 years. The businesswoman and apprentice star led negotiations for the club to move to the 2012 Olympic Stadium in 2016. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello and welcome to Drive on Times Radio with me, John Pienaar. Thanks for your company. Appointing Peter Mandelson as Britain's ambassador to Washington has been a disaster for Keir Starmer, and it just keeps getting worse. Now, maybe the Prime Minister thought sacking his head of the diplomatic service, Sir Oliver Robbins, over the tangle surrounding Mandelson's security vetting would ease the pressure on him. In which case, Starmer thought wrong. He chose the wrong scapegoat. And today, Ollie Robbins got his revenge. Robbins didn't just testify to a committee of MPs that Starmer's team applied huge pressure on him to approve Mandelson's ambassadorship, but we expected that to happen. No, he threw in almost casually, as if the thought had just occurred to him that he'd been forced to object when Team Starmer wanted to make the Prime Minister's press secretary, Matthew Doyle, an ambassador somewhere. Objected that it would be wrong to appoint a new ambassador with no qualifications to do the job, and especially wrong when experienced diplomats were being laid off. Robbins didn't use the word cronyism, because he didn't have to. Doyle was made a peer, and you may know him better, as the man who was later kicked out of the party over a past association with a convicted paedophile. So in a single brief burst of testimony, without a single harsh or bitter word, Sir Ollie Robbins gave an object lesson in how he'd come to be Britain's top diplomat and a Whitehall Mandarin, and why Keir Starmer made a big mistake when he decided to offer up Robbins' scalp in the hope of saving his own. Suddenly a Prime Minister who's always cast himself as a model of straight dealing and integrity, a man who genuinely prides himself on his high standards of conduct, was being portrayed as a leader more concerned with getting Peter Mandelson into the US Embassy than respecting national security safeguards, and more interested in getting his close lieutenant into an embassy anywhere than his qualifications to serve as British ambassador anywhere. Now, will this so subtle encounter, this attack, finally wreck Starmer's premiership? Well, I doubt it. The Prime Minister will likely carry on under the same enormous pressure, and maybe that's worse. Tell me what you think. Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So it was quite a show. Ollie Robbins, he gave 2.5 hours of evidence to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, starting with the start of his time at the Foreign Office.
The handover briefing I was getting as I arrived at post was what I felt was a generally dismissive attitude to his vetting clearance. The focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly. Despite this atmosphere, an atmosphere of pressure, the department completed developed vetting to the normal high standard.
Now, Robbins described the conditions of Mandelson's appointment.
I'm afraid I don't think at the point of his appointment and 4 days thereafter it was actually a given that he would be vetted. Again, if you look at the documents submitted under the humble address, there is no stipulation from Number 10 that he should be vetted. The welcome that was sent to him immediately afterwards doesn't say welcome to the Foreign Office subject to vetting.
He revealed that Number 10 had tried to push another political appointment. This time, it was Matthew Doyle, the communications director, a chief of mission, an ambassador, and that's the job that he wanted for his close lieutenant.
I thought this would be difficult for the Foreign Office. It was difficult for me personally, honestly, as a leader, to explain why very talented and experienced diplomats were having to leave the organisation, and people who would be widely considered to have rather fewer credentials were being put in these important jobs. So it was very difficult for me, and I explained that. I don't know what led to the idea being withdrawn.
Now, he described also leaving the Foreign Office, a job he loved after a quarter of a century of service.
As a human being, I'm desperately, desperately sad about it, Mr. Carden. I love that job. I love that institution. I was proud to serve this government and any government that might follow it.